This week's pundit is our largely libertarian thinker, Eric Crampton, head of research at the New Zealand Initiative. Kia ora, Eric.
Good evening.
Welcome back tonight.
Thank you.
Housing and the election. Now, we've spoken about housing before and whether there's a housing crisis, and I'm pretty sure at the time, but I'll ask you again, is this as big an issue as many of us in the media seem to think it is?
I think it's at least as big an issue as the media is putting up. As the media is portraying, and it's more pervasive than just the lack of housing, right? So it shows up across all kinds of different policy areas. So we saw it this weekend in stories about difficulty in sourcing teachers in Auckland, that it's just too expensive for them to find housing. So when you've got fairly flat pay scales across the country for teachers, you can't afford to hire them in places where it's really expensive to live. So we'll see it there. We'll see it showing up in some of the productivity stats, where if it's really tough for people to move to the places where jobs are, that'll have some national consequences. We'll see it in interest rates being higher than they otherwise might be to try and keep housing prices down. Long term, that doesn't really help, though. There's a real shortage in housing.
Housing seems to wrap itself around a lot of concerns. And there are, housing means different things to different people in the community. So middle-class New Zealanders might worry about being able to afford the right house in the right part of town. And poorer folk might simply worry about being able to afford a rental that is either dry or warm enough, or maybe even just afford a rental at all.
Oh, totally agree. It showed up also in earlier this month. There was a Roy Morgan survey where they asked people what their biggest concern going into the election is. And a lot of the reporting around that one was focusing on poverty and the gap between rich and poor. 14% of people said that was their biggest concern. But the next biggest concern was house prices and housing affordability. That was 13.7%. And the next one after that was housing shortages and homelessness. So that was 9.6%. If you add the two housing categories together, it swamps the poverty and inequality number. And you have to wonder whether the concern around poverty and inequality is really a concern about housing. The Ministry of Social Development's annual survey of incomes came out again this year, and it reported about the same thing as it's reported for the last several years, where income inequality has been pretty flat, but we have real big problems in hardship, mostly caused by housing issues.
It's either because we see housing as so important. Well, it is so important. I mean, in the end, that's a dumb thing for me to say, really. Basically, if you haven't got a roof over your head, or you haven't got a roof over your head which you feel happy about, that is a barrier to feeling good about yourself and maybe to feeling jealous of other people or whatever.
When there are a fixed number of houses to go around because the government has made it so hard for people to build new houses, then getting a house is a competition, and you see everybody as your competitors. And I think that fuels a lot of some of the anti-migrant sentiment, the xenophobic campaigns around Chinese names. It all has that housing underlying issue.
So for you, and we've gone, as I said before, we've talked about this, and let's just briefly recap from your point of view. Why have we got ourselves, or how have we got ourselves into this problem?
Well, we've gotten into this problem through decades of very restrictive zoning rules, where councils set the rules that prevent intensification in town and prevent expansion into the suburbs. When you combine restrictions on putting up new houses with increased demand for new housing, prices can only go one way, and that's up. The more interesting question is, why do councils set rules that block affordable housing, that make it really hard to build? And there we've done a bit of work trying to look at councils' incentives. So there, councils bear a lot of costs from growth, especially if they're hitting up against their debt limits. If you put in place new infrastructure to facilitate more growth, and you're getting up to your debt limit, and if you go over it, you're going to be facing higher interest costs on all of your existing debt. Your existing set of ratepayers really aren't going to like that, because they're then bearing higher costs in their rates or getting lower services. The ratings increase that council will get with an increase in population after you net out these infrastructure costs, there's not much gain in it for them. On the other side, from central government's perspective, they get increased GST revenues when there's more economic activity. They'll see an increase in income tax revenues from a growing city. They'll see increased business taxes when businesses are able to thrive because zoning works and people are able to live and prosper in a place. When the gains go to central government and the costs go to local government, you've got a recipe for conflict. So it's understandable why they've been butting heads for the past decade over this.
And in terms of Auckland, just looking at Auckland for a moment, there is a lot of resistance in some of those inner city suburbs to greater intensification. It hasn't been plain sailing in terms of, okay, we need to go up in town.
Yep.
People say, I don't want a multi-story block next to me, next to my villa.
Yep. And some of that's an artifact of how we run the zoning process, right? So if you start considering a nice large front yard with nice trees in it as being an amenity for the neighborhood, if your neighbors start upzoning and turning up to townhouses or to an apartment block, that makes it harder for you to subdivide your own property down the track. So, of course, you're going to want to object to your neighbor's densification proposals, even if it doesn't bother you directly. So we've got that problem. And when council itself doesn't benefit that much from intensification, what incentive do they have to fight against NIMBYism, the not in my backyard stuff, in favor of people who don't have houses yet?
However, does any of that really explain why we're so low on lower price housing?
It explains all of it. So if the price of land ends up being driven up by these restrictive zoning rules. Subaru last week, their government agency that analyzes data stuff, they commissioned a report looking at what portion of the cost of a house in Auckland are due to these kinds of regulatory constraints on people building. And they said it was up to 56% of the value of a house in Auckland comes down to these regulatory barriers to new building. So we've locked in a lot of rents. Economists will call them rents. It's different from the rents that tenants will pay. But it's a benefit to the owners of property that are just an artifact of the regulation. Now,
hasn't the national government been pretty slow to respond to a need for social housing? It might have made a difference if there were more social houses. That might have put a downward pressure on rental accommodation.
Well, maybe, but the central government will face the same problem as any private developer in trying to build. They're going to have to get the land consented and zoned. There'll have to be infrastructure to service it. They'll have to get planning permission. They'll have to find builders to do the job. The underlying issue has been zoning. Now, the Auckland Unitary Plan that's now in place fixes a lot of that. There's been a lot of scope for intensification in town, and there's been a lot of scope for expansion into the suburbs. But some of that has been more notional than real, because unless you can get the infrastructure laid to get a new subdivision put in place, you're just not going to be able to get permission to build there.
And would it be fair to say now, Eric, that even if the changes in planning were in place, even if it wasn't as difficult as you say it is for us to get planning approval, for councils to encourage more intensification and for development of greenfield sites, at the moment we actually have a lack of capacity in our construction sector. It's already very busy, isn't it?
Yeah, so that'll be the next problem. So over the weekend, National proposed some changes to infrastructure financing that could go a long way to fixing some of the incentive and infrastructure problems that I was talking about. The next constraints down the line that we're going to hit are number of builders and some other factors in the construction sector. But maybe we'll hit on the infrastructure funding proposal that's now up and how that potentially solves some of the problem before we get into the next branches that we're going to be bashing our heads against.
Tell me a little bit more about what's been offered to voters so far and what you at the initiative think what's been offered.
Okay. Well, on Labor's side, they came out earlier. Phil Twyford there has proposed a lot of sensible things around infrastructure corridors and using value uplift charging to put in place infrastructure to allow more development.
Value uplift charging, what's
so
that?
So there, if you lay down new trunk infrastructure, new highways or public transport or things like that, the value of your land goes up because it offers more services to people. The increase in that value isn't really because of anything you did. It's because of the change in zoning. So what Labor was there proposing was using some of that uplift in value to fund infrastructure by taxing it. Okay, so it'd be a value uplift charge that would help to fund some of the infrastructure development. Now, they've layered on top of that a Kiwi Build program where they'd have massive state construction of new houses. I'm not really sure that that's necessary if you have the infrastructure financing in place and you've solved capacity constraints in the construction sector, because either central government or any private sector developer would have to be getting the zoning right and would have to be getting council to agree to let them build. That requires having the infrastructure solved and a way around council's debt constraints. Labor's value uplift charging is one way around that.
National has been offering some low-interest loans to councils so they can deal with debt, but they still, to some extent, it's still debt to the councils.
Yeah.
And some, for example, Auckland councils, about its higher debt as it thinks it can handle at the moment.
So that's the Housing Infrastructure Fund, and that's not really gone anywhere. It's not had much uptake for precisely the reason that you mentioned. It's low interest, but it's still debt on the council's books. They are hitting their interest to overall budget limits, after which they trigger a worse credit rating and higher interest costs. Now, arguably, that's a cost worth bearing anyway. Because of the magnitude of the housing problem, the extra interest cost is small in the grand scheme of things, but it's still being a barrier to council really doing anything. What came out this weekend was a little bit different. So that's a proposal where, well, it's building on some of the ideas that we were talking about starting in 2013, where we were wanting to have private ways of funding new infrastructure development. We were calling them there. Well, I wasn't with the initiative yet, so it was Oliver and the team then that were calling them community development districts. So the idea on that one is having a special ratings area on a new subdivision that pays a levy that covers the cost of the infrastructure. So if you need new trunk infrastructure, you issue some bonds, you put a special ratings area on the properties that benefit from the new infrastructure. They pay off those bonds with a targeted rate over the lifespan of the infrastructure. You want to have the debt matching the lifespan of the infrastructure. That just works out better because then you can just run it forever, right? You need new infrastructure, issue new debt, it all works out. That gets around the council financing constraint because it's a separate vehicle. It's on a private sector's books rather than on council's books, so it's not on council's debt limit. So long as you structure it properly, you'd have to make sure that the debt is there subordinate to any rates due to council, some complicated ratings agency stuff, but it can all be handled.
Is that, to some extent, what National was talking about now?
Well, National's come close to that. So what they're proposing is a more big government approach to trying to do the same thing. So instead of having private development associations issuing that debt and then levying the ratings, they're having a central government fund established to lay the infrastructure, to put in the new special rating area, to collect the rates on it, and then eventually to sell that off. I think in National's view, the debt markets aren't quite sophisticated or deep enough here to be able to handle that kind of offering, at least not yet. And potentially there's room for something more like community development districts yet down the track.
However, that doesn't address the other issue you were talking about.
No, it doesn't.
Which is how are we going to get the materials, the building materials, and the workers there to build the houses?
Well, that one's starting to worry me now a lot more because before this happened, any of those kinds of problems didn't affect house prices nearly as much as you might think. So the regulations like minimum apartment sizes or minimum balcony sizes, all of those things add to the cost of putting up new dwellings, but they add to it in a weird way because of the tight land markets. They reduce the amount that a developer is willing to pay for a piece of land because they get less value out of the development, right? So the overall cost of what gets developed doesn't get affected as much. Once land markets are freed up, like the unitary plan has done, and once you've freed things up with infrastructure, like the new housing fund is going to be doing, then all of that flips. And you can get land prices down to what they should be in competitive markets. You can leapfrog around any land banks, open more land up because we've now more flexible arrangements for infrastructure. But all of the added cost from having a shortage of construction workers or a construction sector that really isn't up to the kind of scale that's now necessary, that'll now factor into house prices.
Well, how do we deal with that? Do we import more workers? I mean, do we actually have to target and go looking for workers? But we also need to import materials, don't we?
Yep. I think that it would be difficult for the local construction industry to scale up to the magnitude of the problem we've got. They're talking about a 35,000 house shortfall currently. That's probably an underestimate. They're talking about the shortfall increasing by 40 houses a day. There are foreign companies that are used to building subdivisions at scale. None of these guys can come in easily currently because of the Overseas Investment Act. There's no way they'd be able to accumulate enough land to do it without triggering the Overseas Investment Act constraints, and that's a big hassle. If they were able to get over that barrier, they would still have trusted work teams that they'd like to bring with. They're going to be hitting against tightening immigration regimes. They would have trusted supply chains for the materials that they're used to using for building houses. And maybe fair enough that we wouldn't want to use materials that really aren't suitable for a New Zealand environment. But if you've got builders that are used to putting up big subdivisions in Tokyo or Vancouver or Seattle or other places that have substantial seismic risk and have already dealt with their own leaky buildings crisis, it seems a little silly to think that those materials wouldn't be good enough for here too.
Is one of the reasons that we've got ourselves into this mess now is because the national government, to some extent, because it's most of its core support comes from people who own property. And they, through property prices rising, they see the value of their assets increasing. And at least initially that might seem to all concerned a good thing. And you don't want to undermine the value of their assets or do anything that might threaten them. And then you have a national may be reluctant to spend money on a whole lot of state houses because it's ideologically worried about creating more ghettos. And then we've got another thing which isn't actually to do with this government, but is the fact that we're still dealing with maybe all that construction work created by those leaky buildings that have had to be fixed because they weren't built properly in the first place at the start of the century and the end of the last.
Well, I wouldn't have the numbers on what portion of the construction sector is tied up in lingering leaky building issues.
Yeah, but I do wonder that.
I'd be surprised if it were substantial at this point. I'll agree that part of the political barrier has been worries among those who already have houses about reducing the value of their home. It's worth remembering, too, though, that if you allow densification and you now have the right to subdivide, housing can get cheaper while the owners of existing houses are not made worse off. Because instead of owning $1 million house, you might own two $750,000 townhouses, right, on the same property if you upzone. So that's been part of the problem. I think part of the problem, too, has been not really recognizing the role of incentives in this, where you'll often hear this from central government that they don't want to provide stronger incentives to, like, Auckland to accommodate population growth because they don't want to do things that they would view as Invercargill paying for Auckland's problem. We'd proposed having the GST component of new construction going back to the council that facilitates construction so that they gives them a bit more skin in the game and another way of helping to defray the infrastructure costs so it's less costly for councils to accommodate growth. Central government has been worried that local government are not always competent and there'd be worries about taking money from one part of the country and giving it to another. Really, though, if you put that kind of a program in across the board, you're giving back to council money for activity that's happening in their region. It's not money from Invercargill going to Auckland. It's money that Auckland would have been sending to central government, staying in Auckland instead to help solve Auckland's problems so it doesn't wreck the rest of the country.
You don't think a capital gains tax would have done anything to slow down the
a capital gains
expansion
tax,
and the value of the housing stock?
I don't think so. I think it would have had a capital gains tax should have a one-off drop in the value of houses because if you're buying a house, you're buying a tax stream that goes with it, right? So the value of that house to you goes down, so you should be willing to pay a little bit less for it at the outset. But it shouldn't affect the path of house prices. You can get some complicated arguments about ways that it might. But those same arguments also would say that you can mitigate most of the problem by solving a different problem that we have in the income tax system that's potentially easier to solve. So right now, if you've got money in a savings account, you're taxed on inflation, right? So if the interest rate that you're getting at the bank is 3% on a term deposit and we've got a 1.5% inflation rate, you're being taxed at double the rate you should be because inflation is half of the nominal return you're getting. If you were to exempt the inflation component of interest from taxation so that you're only taxed on the real value of it, that would reduce the disparity between real assets and financial assets, which could go a long way to solving the problem.
And here's my final question, Eric. At the back of my mind is a concern, at least when it comes to, I guess, the housing stock for middle-income and high-income New Zealanders, is that we are seeing a asset bubble develop and at some point it'll just go pop.
Well, that is worrying. It would be very nice. Well, in one sense, it'd be kind of good if housing prices did drop because we do have that would signal that we have solved the housing shortage, right?
Yeah. Now, but not through the floor in a few months.
it's just not going to happen. The housing shortage is too big relative to ongoing demand. There's no way for the construction sector to gear up quickly enough to solve that. You might expect that if the sector takes seriously what's potentially going to happen with new infrastructure financing, you could see a minor drop in house prices because of that. So you're anticipating the effects on future housing shortages of this coming in. But it's going to take so long to fix this, even if we get policy right, that I'm a little less worried about it. But you are right that when you have things set very tightly, you expose the whole sector to more risk of price fluctuation, because that's the only margin that can really change when things are tight on supply.
Eric, thanks very much for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
Eric Crampton, Head of Research at the New Zealand Initiative, back with more largely libertarian thoughts in a couple of months.